Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, June 29th, 2001. In the fireside room this morning is Kristen Wee. Today's session is Esther and Estrogen. What does that pesky, necessary hormone have to do with Esther and Moses? Let's listen in.
Lutheran Church in Austin, Minnesota, and I'm so glad you're here. I mentioned these two books yesterday, and I went up to the bookstore and grabbed a copy of each of these so I could show them to you. This is From Eve to Esther, Rabbinical Reconstructions of Biblical Women. This got littles of interesting information that we don't get in our traditional Christian studies of characters in the Old Testament. And this is Out of the Garden, Women Writers on the Bible, a collection of different authors, and wonderful insights in this book as well.
Are the articles in there mainly about women, or is it just women writing about everything in the Bible?
Good question. It's not all about women. For example, Phyllis Trible, who is one of the greatest Old Testament scholars around today, her chapter is The Odd Couple, Elijah and Jezebel. it's so clever. It's just lots and lots of fun. I don't know. I've got a little line of free golf books I want to read. Let's begin with a word of prayer. Holy and gracious God, we give you thanks for this time together. Open our hearts to the moving of your Spirit here. And help us this day to enjoy the beauty of your creation and your presence in it, and give us the gift of laughter. In Jesus' name we pray.
Amen.
Okay, this is supposed to be a Bible study on Esther, but if anybody asks you today if you've been to a Bible study, you'll have to be very careful what you're answering. Because there's not a lot of Bible in this. Esther is a wonderful book in the Old Testament, but it's, well, let me quick give a little summary of what the book of Esther is about. Esther herself is a Jewish orphan who wins a beauty contest, becomes the wife of the king, and then foils a plot by an evil government official to annihilate all the Jews. But the interesting thing about the book is that Esther really doesn't do much in the book. It's Mordecai. The book is really about Mordecai, who is Esther's cousin and guardian. And he is the true hero of the book. If you look at what the ancient rabbis say about Esther, they say Esther is the Jewish ideal of beauty, but even more of sexual attractiveness. And so the rabbis just rhapsodize on the beauty and the magnificence of this female Jewish ideal. And so then you read the book of Esther and you find out that after this arch enemy Haman dies and his sons are killed in a battle, the Jewish ideal of femininity, Esther has these two bodies of the sons impaled in public. Yeah, I mean, why? You've got to wonder about that. Anyway, the book of Esther has been billed as many by several scholars as either a satire or a farce. And it doesn't make the book any less sacred or any less interesting, but I think it really does open up some new ways of looking at the book of Esther, which never mentions the name of God. And the only other book in the Old Testament that does that is Song of Songs. Nothing about God in Song of Songs or in Esther. So how do they even get the Bible? Well, there's something important to teach us. And I do think that at least has something to do with farce and with... Never mind. Okay. We'll just do this. I'm trying to decide if I'm going to be sorry for this. The title of this session is Esther and Estrogen, subtitled The Midlife Musings of a Menopausal Matron. And this is based in part on a recently discovered ancient manuscript that has a surprising new view on Moses. Now, this is much shorter than yesterday, so just bear with me. I'll go through this. Just a short time ago, I picked up a magazine and read another one of those articles about the unfairness women have to put up with in our society. Did you know that car dealers make as much as 37% more profit selling cars to women than to men? And according to an AMA report, women still undergo more lab tests, are given more prescriptions, and are called back for more visits with the doctor than men. The statistic that really got my goat was the one about clothing. Not only do similar garments cost more in the women's department than in the men's, but dry cleaners charge up to 3 times as much for a woman's shirt as for a man's shirt. Well, that makes me mad because it's not fair. Women and men all over should rise up in rebellion. Women get the bad end of the deal all over the place, but where it really gets bad is when we get older. How many faces of mature women, say, over 60, do you see in Vogue magazine? One maybe, or two? And it's usually with an article entitled something like Granny and Me. Did you know that in a recent study of characters appearing in primetime television dramas in one major city, out of 464 roles, only 7 of them were women who appeared to be over 60? Another study found that only 2 out of 100 TV commercials contained older characters. Now, this will really get your goat, if you're one of the mature types. In a national survey of American adults, it was found that the majority of Americans agree that most people over 65 are, number one, not very physically active, number two, not very sexually active, three, not very open-minded or adaptable, and four, not very useful members of their communities. That makes me mad. I feel buried under pressure not to look old, not to act old, and I'm dragging around exhausted from step aerobics and dreaming of plastic surgery. And besides, I'm expected to argue even harder with the car salesman and the dry cleaner. Then in the midst of my anger and frustration, it hits me. It's estrogen. It's all a matter of having too much or too little. Did you know that the root word of the word estrogen means frenzy? It's appropriate. In my frenzy of frustration, as I'm thrashing around looking for a convenient person to be angry with, I settle on someone who seems to be an unlikely candidate, Esther. Now, I know it's not her fault that the hormone at the root of all these problems got named after her. She didn't plan it that way. It was an accident. But Esther clearly had too much of it. She was a beauty queen. Now, one of my middle-aged friends who had won a pageant years earlier told me that her husband called her his change-of-life beauty queen. She moaned that now she wasn't called pretty anymore, but pretty for a woman her age. Well, not so for Esther. The rabbis say that she remained eternally young. I don't believe a word of it. Unless she discovered a raw, souped-up form of the hormone that eventually came to bear her name. According to the ancient rabbis, Esther was one of the 4 most beautiful women God ever created. The other 3 were Sarah, Rahab, and Abigail, all gorgeous, all loved by the ancient rabbis, and they all had too much of it, estrogen. Everyone who is young and beautiful has too much of it. And look at the effect it had. The men fell over at the feet of these women. And the rabbis did years later, after the women were long gone. Read the book of Esther again. It's a good romantic adventure, and it actually has a lot of comic relief. But it never mentions God. It reads like a secular novel. How did it ever get in the Bible? Despite the secular nature of the book, Esther is proclaimed a prophetess by the ancient rabbis. Get serious. On what basis? Well, according to the Talmud, the decision to proclaim Esther a prophetess rests on one verse in chapter 5. Now it came to pass on the third day that Esther clothed herself in royalty. So what? Well, according to the rabbis, this means that the Holy Spirit clothed her. Good grief. They made her a prophet because she was gorgeous. They loved her. There are pages and pages of rabbinic material on Esther's sex appeal and appearance. You don't need to go to the adult bookstore. This stuff is so erotic, it's borderline pornographic. And if you don't believe me, just look at this book. Definitely a case of too much estrogen. It makes people crazy. And it's clear from reading the old rabbis just who had too much and who had too little. They rhapsodize about Susanna and Hannah and Abigail and Judith and the four beauty queens. They were all beautiful, and they were young and gentle. Plenty of estrogen. It's another situation altogether when they take up Aseneth. Does anybody know who Aseneth is? No? See? Joseph's wife. And Deborah and Huldah. These are the ones the rabbis call arrogant and independent. So they were all older. And they were into public leadership. Bad news for a woman back then. Definitely too little estrogen. They were powerful, capable, resourceful leaders, but they got bad press. And I bet all because of low estrogen levels. And it's still true today. If you want to be a CEO or a bishop or even a senior pastor, it's best if you have no estrogen at all. The more I read, the more I realize that I have been an estrogen junkie all my life. My body makes it. My body needs it. It calms me down. It makes me feel good. It gives me sexual power. It makes me feel like a woman. When I was on it, I was on top of the world. I had it all. Youth, fresh skin, a great sex life, a monthly cycle. But all that has changed. My supply has dried up. My source has gone out of business. My ovaries have gone bust, hit rock bottom, hormonal hell. It's time to kick this hormonal dependency and move on, rabbis or no rabbis. So I read my Bible, and with my typical but artificial estrogen frenzy, I'm looking for a hero to rescue me from this dilemma. And there he is, right in front of my eyes. Believe it or not, it's Moses. Now, we need to take Moses more seriously. Back before indoor plumbing, tranquilizers, feminine hygiene, laundromats, and mental hospitals, Moses had some rather liberating things to say. Back before estrogen, hysterectomies, and insurance companies that pay for only 2 days maternal care, the Mosaic Law set down some glorious rules to govern women's lives during that period of time when we are flooded with estrogen. Back then, they called it unclean. Face it, at times we are unclean. The problem is that male theologians have tried to brainwash us into believing that all those Old Testament laws on uncleanness were meant as God's insult to the female of the species. The truth, however, is that the laws found in Leviticus 12 and 15 would be a terrible nuisance to men and a blessing to women. With Moses on our side, who needs estrogen? Now listen to this. When a woman has a discharge of blood, which is her regular discharge from her body, she shall be in her impurity for 7 days, and whoever touches her shall be unclean until the evening. Whoever touches her bed shall wash his own clothes. And if a man lies with her and her impurity is on him, he shall be unclean for 7 days, and every bed on which he lies shall be unclean. Now, if you listen carefully to those lines, you will not find anywhere where she is to get up and do his laundry.
Is there a different version of this?
There might be after this question. Okay, there's more. If a woman has a discharge of blood for many days, not at the time of her impurity, all the days of the discharge she shall continue in uncleanness, as in the days of her impurity. But if she is cleansed of her discharge, she shall count for herself 7 days, and after that she shall be clean. Now it looks to me as if a woman who is really having a tough time not only gets out of doing the laundry, she also gets to spread out a beach towel and lie in the sun for a week of recovery. And as if that weren't enough, Moses goes on to suggest the following remedy for postpartum blues. If a woman conceives and bears a male child, then she shall be unclean for 7 days. As at the time of her flow of blood, she shall continue for 33 days in the blood of her purifying. She shall not touch any hallowed thing, nor come into the sanctuary until the days of her purifying are completed. Imagine, 7 whole days without household chores, plus 33 more in which she shall piously refuse to drive hallowed things like a car. The man gets to struggle with the groceries. And Sunday morning, she can use the Bible itself to avoid having to get the kids ready, fix her hair, and set out breakfast. The choir will just have to get along without her. At last, some quiet and serene Sunday mornings. There's more. If she bears a female child, then she shall be unclean for 2 weeks, 14 glorious days, and she shall continue in her purifying for 66 days. Leave it to good old Moses to give us twice as much time off as we, if we have a girl, than if we have a boy. Who needs estrogen? So I get out my pen to do some figuring. Back in the days when I had an overload of that pesky hormone, I gave birth to 3 daughters. That's 320 vacation days I have coming. And 1 son, that's another 40, plus at least 35 years of monthly cycles, that's 3,430 vacation days. Altogether, I have 3,790 vacation days coming to me. Goodbye, estrogen. Hello, Moses. Well, that Bible study is a stretch of the imagination, but I think it might help us to approach a book like Esther a little differently. I mean, think of it as being a satire or a farce, and even some humor in looking at the laws of Leviticus. Any comments or...
How are you differentiating farce and satire?
I don't know. Anybody want to explain that one, farce and satire?
I'm not an English major, so...
They are really close to, there are common elements in both. Who's an English major and wants to describe that? Dan, you are.
My mind is in a tailspin.
He's lively.
I think farce has more physical humor in it, for one thing.
Yeah, and when I think of farce, I think of those old Western melodramas, kind of.
People are falling down and throwing things.
And satires are very finely drawn pictures of people and situations that represent society but are overdone for the sake of either caustic humor or fun humor. Oof, that's not a very good definition, but sort of close enough. But any other comments, or anybody wants to say something intelligent about Esther?
She did have the courage to speak up, didn't she?
She really did. Mordecai told her exactly what to do and exactly what to say, but Esther hadn't done it.
Right. She had some, there was some personal risk involved.
Absolutely, yeah. Let me share with you this little introduction. It's just like four sentences. By Selina Spiegel to the little essay in here on Esther. The book of Esther has always struck me as one of the strangest books in the biblical canon. Even the Jewish celebration of the story, the carnival holiday of Purim, when all Jews are commanded to get drunk, is an anomaly among Jewish holidays. All cultures have their carnival, but only when I realized that the literary genre most closely connected to carnival is the satire did the book of Esther come into clearer focus for me. Suddenly, Esther was no longer the straightforward, virtuous heroine I'd always thought her. And for the first time, I began to understand why the story bears her name when so much of the credit for the salvation of the Jewish people belongs to Mordecai, the Jew. So that's a little introduction. There aren't any other comments. What I thought we would do with the rest of our time is to see what kind of gifts those of us who are older and more mature have to pass on to the younger people in our communities. There really are some things that come to being beyond the period of estrogen and maybe even into retirement that the younger people have to look forward to. So let's divide up into groups of four or five and just have conversations among ourselves about what some of those things are, and then we'll share them together in the whole group after we've had like 10 minutes of time to talk to each other. So just think of things that you would like to, if you're younger, look forward to later on in life. Those of you who have experienced them, share them. What some of the blessings are. And there are blessings for both men and women.
Thank you.
Sexual fulfillment is just for the young. And reality is, a lot of the research says that by self-report that couples in their 40s, 50s, and 60s have much better sex lives, much more fulfilling, much higher levels of intimacy, much more passionate, erotic sex. And young kids, I mean, they're just finding out what their bodies are even for.
Practice makes perfect.
Practice. That's why that expression of practicing homosexuals. Thank you. That's so true.
In our group, one of the main comments was, with maturity comes a confidence in a person being who we are. And we were saying, especially like going back for, you know, either high school or college reunions, the first year's, the 5th or 10th, even maybe 15th reunion, you think, oh dear, you know, what am I looking good enough, and, you know, am I in the right job, and things like that. By the time you get to the 40th reunion or so, it's, let's just have fun, and it's really great to be together.
Yeah, that's right. You know, David, we said almost that exact same thing on the session before this one. And what a gift it is when you can just kind of be who you are and you don't have this question. Yeah, wonderful. What else?
Well, Well, I'm looking forward to a little more time and freedom.
A little more time and freedom, yeah. Although, you know, I know a lot of retired people who are busier than they've ever been before, like, but they're busy doing things they're choosing to do, want to do.
I think we also talked about that with some maturity, you talked about what wisdom is. I think there is wisdom. There's perspective on life that you can look over, having lived a number of years, and you understand that there are ups and downs in life. Mm-hmm. And I think there's more evenness as you approach that, in the sense that this isn't the end of the world because I've gone through this particular experience. Yeah. Or, wow, you know, there's a sense in which you have a longer view of life and its ups and downs, and there's a better perspective on that.
Yeah.
And you accept that as real.
Yeah.
Live life.
How many of you had an older mentor in your life that you could learn some of those things from? How many of you had somebody like that? I have experienced that as such a blessing, having somebody that I could go to who had the time and the perspective that was so different from where I'm at. And the person was available, and because they were older, they did have the time to listen and reflect. I heard a lot of laughter in these groups. I'm really curious as to what you're talking about.
That was the sex group.
Oh, okay. But there's something over here, too.
We talked a little bit about trying to strike this balance between being over-responsible. I think sometimes when, you know, you get to be in your late 50s or 60s, you don't have the commitments of jobs, your kids are growing up, and you get asked to be on all these boards and, you know, do all these projects, and we were talking a little bit how we think maybe it's important to feel the freedom to develop more your creative side, and I said I'd like to have a sermon preached on that, you know, the creativity, that's really a quality that, you know, God is a creative, I mean, the essence of God is a creative spirit, and I don't think maybe we were saying there's a kind of a sense that I'd love to go do this little art project or learn how to do, I don't know, several different things, but then you see the bumper sticker, if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem, so you think, oh, no, I gotta go, you know, help paint the church or do all these projects and solve all these problems, and you know, part of that's an important thing to do, but maybe there's a sense too that we need to take some time now and nourish our creative side.
Yeah, thank you so much. And I've been thinking about that in Rebecca Wee's session. She's pulling creative writing out of people that didn't know that they had that gift. And hopefully at that time of life, we will have the time to discover some pieces of ourselves that are creative that we didn't even know were there.
Time takes some of those, how many thousand days we had?
What? Chuck.
Now, piggybacking a little bit about what you said, Dave mentioned, mentioned in an earlier session about being who you are.
Yeah.
It's about the same time you are more concerned about who you have in your life rather than what you have in your life.
Say some more about that.
Well, people become more important than things.
Yeah.
And I think there's a transition, and the earlier that can take place, the earlier maturity can take place, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, what a wonderful interview. That's super.
It's a letting go process. You know, you have to simplify. You know, otherwise, you won't have the time that Chuck's talking about. You simply have to downsize.
Not easy to do, though, Lloyd, is it? I mean,
no,
some of us.
It's not, but it's important. Otherwise, you simply, as this gentleman mentioned, you know, you won't get the time to look at the long haul.
Yeah.
And the irony is, when your life is getting into, you know, late November and early December, all of a sudden, you know, it's short on the calendar, and yet the irony is you're able to finally look at life on a long-term basis. And I think that's crucial, because otherwise you can't gain some wisdom that the Spirit gives you to pass on to your grandkids or your kids.
Yeah. All right. Good. Thank you.
And just piggybacking again, the things we have in our life, we either have to protect them or maintain them.
That's true.
Or both, you know.
Yeah. Okay.
So if you get rid of the things, then you can go about protecting and maintaining friendships with people, you know, spend that time.
Yeah.
I thought he was talking about downsizing and simplifying in his mind, though.
Yeah.
Had nothing to do with physical things.
Well, I think the two are together.
Isn't there more head work to do than having the garage sale?
Yeah, but the head comes after the garage sale, because you got to get the garage sale out of your system or get rid of the stuff.
Take my case. I got a great shop and lots of tools and lots of ideas to do with it, but I haven't given myself the freedom to do it.
You guys are still having sex during all this time?
I can think of three pardon the expression quickies that wisdom delivered by elderly people. One was when you and I were buying a house, and she said, the more you got, the more it takes.
Margaret Winter.
Yep. That was great advice, and of course it's true. And then, I can't remember Youngdahl Nelson's first name.
Ruth
Youngdahl Nelson told us many years ago, don't accumulate.
And she was telling us that as she was giving us her stuff.
And another is that there is some psychologist, a female, whose name I cannot recall, who wrote, and they put it out on tape, a program on de-junking your life.
Yep.
Very, a lot of common sense that I was...
Again, mostly a mental thing.
Unable to do. Right.
He's talking about
getting rid of some of your tools.
When we started coming here, we had kids 3 and 6, and we were a young couple, and Gertrude took us aside and told us, listen, the best thing you can spend your money on, outside of coming to Holden Village once a year, is to buy education with it and travel with it.
Because those are the two things no one can ever take away from you. Yeah. I remember hearing that.
Love is the same way if it's in the same class.
Love.
You give it away, but you still have it. Mm-hmm. Everything material can, you know, be ruined in a storm or whatever.
Yeah.
But education, travel, you can share it, but you still have it.
And you talk about it forever, Bob.
Well, I think some of the things that you still have, Roger, I got a lot of Mark Twain's talks this week on work and how work, you know, what is work? Is working in his shop work? Is going to a job where you get paid to work if you enjoy it? What work is and stuff is really an important thing when people get to the point where they can retire, for example. And we had a couple people who feel that work is more fun as you get older, that your kids it's not hour to hour with your kids anymore, and the tension between work and family goes away because your family's not right there in your face all the time. Work actually gets to be a little more fun. And you get better at your work.
Thanks,
Bob. We also talked, I think it relates to a number of these, and we just became grandparents 17 months ago. And we were told by many people what it was like to be a grandparent. Until you experience it, you really don't know what that is. And that is the difference between just being with our granddaughter. Instead of worrying about all the details about this, that, and the other thing, of raising her, we can simply be with her.
Yeah.
And that was different than being with our children. We were concerned about all the day-to-day activities. And even though we've had our granddaughter with us alone for several days at a time and have to take care of making sure she's fed and all that, it's still different. We are just there.
Yeah.
We can be who we are with her.
Well, and don't you think that life is qualitatively different for a child who's had a grandparent?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. One of the great gifts that our children have is they've known their grandparents.
Yeah.
Because in our case, we didn't necessarily know that.
Yeah.
And our children got to experience, and that was very important in their life.
Yeah. What a great gift we can look forward to giving.
Oh, my comment is more applicable to what was being said before, but we've talked quite a bit about the irrelevance of stuff as you get older, and that really came home to me and to my husband when in the last few years we have had to clean out the homes of our parents who had either had to move into nursing homes or in one case died, and we saw all this stuff. Both of our parents were savers, and so they had houses full of stuff. And we were literally picking up armfuls of stuff and tossing them out. It got to that point because we all lived in different towns. We didn't have a huge amount of time to sort through everything. And I thought, you know, it made me go home and look at my house and think, you know, when are my kids going to want to just pitch? and why don't I just pitch it now and not have to worry about it?
Or how can we make it into gift? You know, Dan's family, his parents were way ahead of the time, I think. When they downsized housing, they developed this system. They listed on two or three sheets of single-spaced paper all the items they didn't want anymore. And then they circulated it among the four kids. The oldest child chose one, and then it went to the second child. The second child chose their top choice. And it kept going around in the four children until every item was taken care of. And it was wonderful. I mean, so they de-junked their life in a way that became gift to the children. Yeah.
You
get to think creatively.
Then you watch the antique show, and then you don't throw the first one away because it had value.
Other thought on that, we've been blessed by our parents on special events, for instance, the birth of our children, giving us a family heirloom on that occasion. And that has been so touching to us to get a ring or a necklace or a pocket watch, you know, when I was in the hospital and they just given birth. And with a story, you know, telling me the history, because I might not remember it. And that's been just priceless.
Oh, what a wonderful idea. Thank you for sharing that. We're about to have our first grandchild, though. Yeah, Laura.
I guess the one thing that was interesting in our group is that the numbers are not necessarily what tells how old someone is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's good. Just
the numbers. I mean, it's not 60 or 80 or 70, but a lot of times it's how they act or how they live their life.
I know 90-year-olds that seem like 50, and I know 40-year-olds that seem like 80, though. Yeah. Any closing?
It's interesting that you've been talking about getting rid of things, and one of the comments in our group was we spend our time with people that we want to spend time with, and the relationships that we really didn't
want to
do what we had to before. So
kind
of like getting rid of the people in your life.
Ooh, I remember that.
We all have those that we feel obligated to spend time with.
Wonderful.
We feel more free to do what we want to do in all areas.
Yeah.
I mean, I've had conversations with my friends about how we don't worry too much.
Pictures I'm going to have on a purple and red muumuu and a big straw hat and a parrot on my shoulder. Oh, goodness. Well, we need to quit it. Laughter is a blessing, though. I picked up this card in the bookstore yesterday. Blessed are we who can laugh at ourselves, for we shall never cease to be amused.